Indeed, and our special guest tonight, Richard C. Hoagland. We're going to chat with Richard for about a half hour, then we'll open up the phone lines. Conversations with Richard in this floating format on Coast to Coast AM. Batting cleanup, Richard C. Hoagland of TheEnterpriseMission.com.
Boy, you take your cues well.
He sure does. How does it feel to have Dr. Tim Ball as your warm-up act?
You know, I was really fascinated because he's hitting on all the same things that I'm looking at now, except I don't think he's quite on top of the curve because the one thing he didn't address is the amazing breakthroughs in this whole solar energy field that I discussed a few weeks ago when we did a kind of a joint thing with your friend Jim Corsi,
mm-hmm.
Jerome Corsi.
Jerome, yeah.
There has been such an amazing breakthrough in the price of thin film solar cells. And I just got an email tonight from one of the companies that I'm plugged into in California. They are now telling everyone that they can produce a municipal power plant for, in essence, a few million dollars that will warm and heat and power and do all the other things for an average home. And instead of taking 10 to 15 years to build,
mm-hmm.
with a coal or an oil or a nuclear plant, it can be ready in a year.
Oh, my gosh.
And I've seen this technology, and, you know, there's this huge problem with what do we do with all the people that used to make cars, used to get out of high school, used to get a really good job in the car companies in Michigan and Detroit,
yeah,
where you hung out.
That's true.
And you can't do that anymore. Well, there's an enormous, burgeoning explosion of jobs in the manufacture and installation of these solar cell farms, about 10 acres. Now, Coral Castle, which you and I know well about.
Down there in Homestead, Florida.
In Homestead, Florida, is about a 10-acre facility. It's about a 10-acre plot. If they simply put solar cells on the back lot of Coral Castle, they could power Homestead, all of Homestead, every home in Homestead. And maybe even the Air Force Base. This is an astonishing breakthrough. When I was listening to the debate tonight between Obama and Senator Clinton, I couldn't help but feel, and, you know, McCain's on the same page. McCain says global warming's a problem. It doesn't matter, frankly, whether it is a problem. That's going to shock some people.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is the political will to change the direction we've been going in, which is disaster at all different levels, to go in a different direction.
Absolutely.
And the technology, I mean, Americans are the inventors of the world. This is kind of like, I mean, you know, for the hard-edged, anomalous people, they're going to be unhappy with me when I say this. But we've been, you know, looking at the Holy Grail of free energy for years and years and years and years, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if we could produce for individual homes or for municipalities, which would then put it into the grid system, and it would be cheaper and less expensive for the individual homeowner because they wouldn't have to put up the front capital cost and all that. And the price of the electricity could go down and down and down. It would be like having free energy.
Absolutely.
Except it doesn't require that we, you know, break down the doors of the Bastille and get the secret plans that some conspiratorial group has been keeping from humanity for all these centuries. It's here now. And what is so amazing to listen to the discussion you had earlier tonight, because as he rightly pointed out, there are huge problems with wind. They are killing millions of birds in these migratory patterns in putting up these huge wind farms. There's huge problems with biofuels. There are people starving tonight, George, because we're diverting corn into politically subsidized ethanol.
Yeah, and rioting.
Used to feeding people. I mean, did you see the news earlier tonight? There's a serious problem with famines in, you know, everywhere from Haiti to the Sudan again.
Oh, I know. And people are rioting. They're upset.
In urban areas, urban poor, because they can't grow anything when you're in a city. If we could bring online, I mean, when I saw the numbers tonight that you could literally replace the coal or oil or natural gas power plant of a municipality in 12 months, that's a year.
That's really incredible. And you could still have that as your backup, right?
Oh, absolutely, because what you would do is for every municipality that made the switch, you'd be able to preserve, conserve that amount of oil for those areas where solar energy is not appropriate.
Exactly, yet. Like cloudy days and stuff.
Well, what you also need is a commensurate a breakthrough in energy, electrical energy storage.
You need the capacitor, right?
Well, you need the ultracapacitor.
Yeah.
Now, there's this guy at MIT who all he needs is money. I mean, this is really a trivial amount of money. This is kind of like the 21st century equivalent of John Kennedy's Apollo project.
Well, why doesn't some venture capital firm fund the guy?
Well, because you need a lot more money than the venture capitalists are willing to put up.
Okay.
Venture capitalists tend to be a little conservative. They want to bet on a sure thing, and they want their return, and God knows how much more money, within a year or two.
Yeah, that's true.
We're not long-term planners. That's where the feds come in. You know, because basically, most of the money that's spent by the government is inflationary, except for the money spent in NASA. Why is NASA money different? Because money spent in NASA and in other R&D programs actually is an investment in making us more wealthy. It's not redistributing wealth. It is making new wealth. Remember, there's only three components to the triad of wealth. There's energy, there's resources, and there's information. And you can lump all the conventional, you know, economic indicators like capital and, you know, labor and all that under one of those three columns.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to invest a trivial amount of federal dollars in bringing to the market as fast as possible these solar breakthroughs and the ultracapacitors to store the energy, because you know what that lets you do, right, George?
That's right.
You can drive a Tesla Roadster.
Absolutely.
You can have an electric car that has more get up and get than any Ferrari you ever sat behind the wheel of.
No, but for a house, for example, Richard, if you were to have these thin solar panels, I guess on the roof,
yep.
Would the whole roof have to be that or just a small portion? How big would it have to be?
Well, you can't beat the solar constant. In other words, you basically have solar panels that cover the roof. Or you put them in your backyard. If you don't have a backyard, you put them on the structure. The problem is, and the reason why it might be an intermediate step to actually have municipalities build their solar farms on, I mean, every community has land that they don't use.
True.
Every community. What this would allow you to do is to put the panels on the ground. You know, they don't even have to track the sun because they don't have to be that efficient. And they don't have to have solar trackers on. They're just these like rows of storm windows. They basically produce peak energy when the sun is at noon and they're oriented toward the south. But they're cheap enough that you can build an overage so that you basically can bring this online. You don't have to interfere with building codes. You don't have to have inspectors climbing all everybody's roofs. You don't have to get waivers and all that. In other words, you don't have to feed money into a bureaucracy. The money goes directly into a power plant that makes electricity. Now, here's what's really, really cool, amazingly cool. If you invest as a municipality in a municipal solar power plant with thin-film solar cells so that everybody in that municipal grid, that electric utility, mm-hmm. basically is having solar energy as opposed to any other kind.
Right.
Over time, the price goes down and down and down because let's assume the solar cell farm is built to last 20 years. That's a typical amortization time,
okay.
Right?
And technology would probably change it, right?
Well, ultimately, you'd get better and better. You can make them last longer and longer because there's no moving parts.
Right.
You know, nothing wears out. You basically don't want ultraviolet to do certain damage, and you don't want rain and, you know, ice and stuff like that. Well, that's just engineering. That's just stupid stuff we've been doing since the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
The miracle part is the thin-film solar cell technology, which is basically printed, like with printing presses, on aluminum foil.
That's amazing. Is it nanotechnology?
Well, yes, it's nano ink. It's a solar active nanotechnology ink. And in fact, now I've seen in the last couple of days another company which is actually claiming that you can make this on your own computer printer at home. They will give you a cartridge.
That's
amazing.
And
you can actually make your own solar cell. All right. Now, obviously, you can't power your house with it, but it'd be nice for toys and, you know, kids' experiments and basically to make people familiar with how incredibly miracleize as technology is. But the key part here is that when you build a nuclear plant or a coal plant or a gas plant, not only do you have to pay for the plant, which is all the gears and the machinery and, you know, the metals and the converters and the turbines and the evaporators and all that, you also have to pay for the fuel. So you're constantly paying for something. If you have thin film solar cell technology, which is now off the shelf, which it is, boys and girls, the breakthrough is here. No more waiting for jam yesterday and tomorrow. It's here today. That means that every kilowatt hour that you use of solar energy from that installation, the price gets amortized over the entire life of the installation. So the price can be dropped and dropped and dropped. I mean, in an era of $4 gas, isn't this really amazing news? Now, what's the one thing that's going to keep this from happening?
Money.
No.
From the other side.
Well,
they don't want
lobbyists,
it out.
For the oil companies and whatever, we're going to claim, oh, you're not going to want this, you're not going to want that. So there's a political will problem. All of the candidates, which is really interesting, all the candidates, whether you're Republican or Democrat or even some other parties that we might talk about later on this evening, have lined up on behalf of a radical change of national energy policy. What I don't think they're aware of yet, because this is so new, and that's why we put a major white paper on the Enterprise website, and we're advising people to go download it and send it to all the candidates as fast as possible.
EnterpriseMission.com.
We want the candidates to know that it isn't jam tomorrow anymore. It's jam today. Because all our other problems that we're facing, up to and including the big bad T word, terrorism, are fundamentally rooted in our incredible dependency on energy, i.e. oil, from the most tempestuous place of real estate on the earth, which is the Middle East.
Absolutely. And plus, you know what, you could tell Iran, here, use this technology. Don't go nuclear.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you sit down in these meetings and you have something to bargain with. And basically what happens here is the United States goes from being energy dependent on a form of energy which is incredibly enslaving to its populations and the rest of the world to being energy independent and an energy producer. And we basically sell the technology to all those countries that are desperately looking to emulate the American lifestyle, but we don't want to because they will kill the planet. I mean, can you imagine if China were to turn around and buy this from us so they could breathe again? I mean, you can't see from one end of a street in Beijing to the other because of the coal-fired smog, which is kind of typical of what was going on in London 100 years ago when they had killing smogs that would literally force old people to die because they couldn't breathe the air.
People are walking around with little masks on.
Yep. This is why whoever is elected in the fall, there has got to be a national Apollo-style energy policy initiative which looks at the big picture. And I am here tonight to give you the good news, coming on the wake of your other guest, that we don't have to wait for any of this stuff to be invented because it's already here, and all we have to do is to have the economies of scale now. And that's where the feds can come in some very elegant ways. Because one of the key things that's going to keep this revolution from happening as fast as it can is obviously legislation.
Mm-hmm.
It's local zoning ordinances. It's state building codes. It's all that. What you do is you mandate through the Congress a set of streamlined codes that allow people that want to put this stuff up on their roof to do so in a way that is equivalently efficient to what they're now spending on things that are simply making us not safe, but much more unsafe.
Now, are you saying that people, individuals, should start doing this on their own, or are we still talking about the big plant in the city?
Well, I think both. You know, obviously, there's a lot of people who listen to us on this show who are cutting-edge pioneers. And if they knew that, you know, I mean, you could do tax credits, you could do all kinds of things in the legislation. You could do things that would make it inviting economically for people to get off the grid. Now, why is getting off the grid ultimately a really good idea? Look at Katrina. Look at New Orleans. Suppose those pumps which were supposed to be, you know, keeping the waters back behind the dike. I mean, when the power failed, when the dikes broke and the water rose in the power plants and they died of by drowning, suppose there had been independent power, solar power with commensurate storage, electrical storage, ultracapacitor battery banks that could have kept those pumps going day and night.
And that would be critical that they would have something.
Absolutely. Like that. And that would be the things that you would look at first. That means that you may have saved God knows how many people's lives because you could have, you know, it's basically the water in, water out. You have a bathtub and you got a drain. And the drain in this case is the pumps. You got a faucet open, you got water pouring into the bathtub. Depending upon which input or output is greater, the bathtub water will either rise or fall. So if the pumps have been able to keep working when the power failed, they could have kept the water from rising dramatically long enough to rescue a lot more people, and a lot fewer people would have been a lot fewer people would have been killed.
What would our friend Gene Maliff had said about this?
Well, because he was alive, working in this area, you know, as multiple areas. This, again, is part of the transitions that I see. Once you get people used to the idea that they can be independent and have a wonderful lifestyle off the grid, I mean, I live here in New Mexico, and just up the mountain from me, there's a whole community that is, you know, they're rich enough to afford it, and they've gone the traditional, you know, silicon solar cell route. The problem is that that's unaffordable for most people. But when the price of the per watt fell below that magic $3, then you get amazing things. I mean, the price per watt of this technology is now down around 36 cents a watt to produce, and they're planning to sell it for a dollar a watt, actually 99 cents, and that's under the $3 limit that everybody's been talking about to be more than competitive with coal and oil and natural gas. This is a revolution that's here, and all it's waiting for is the right president to say, this is what we're going to do. Who wants to get on board?
You're excited about this.
Very, because this is the way we change the world. I mean, if you look at at CNN, you look at MSNBC, you look at Fox, you look at the litany of awful bad news that we've been living with for almost 10 years now, since 2001, since 9/11. I mean, what was the single biggest reason why bin Laden ostensibly killed 3,000 Americans?
Because of our reliance on Saudi oil.
Because we're in Saudi Arabia.
And we're there. Yes. We're physically there.
Now, what you do is you parallel process. If you can excite local communities and you can clear the legislative obstructions and bureaucracy so that municipalities within a couple of years could go from their coal and oil dependence to solar, you imagine what revolution that would create in our Mideast relations, where we basically could say to bin Laden, keep your sand. We've got the sun.
You got it. And the sun is ours, and it's free.
And that changes such dynamics in the international terrorism equation. Because, frankly, if we withdrew, if we didn't, I mean, John McCain's campaign is based on being in the Middle East now for 100 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, why would he want to keep troops? I mean, I want to be very clear and not misstate what he's saying. He says he's making the analogy with Korea or Japan, where we had troops to stabilize the situation and nobody's getting killed. All right, I want to be very clear about that.
It's strategic, he says.
Strategic, yeah. Well, even if we did that, the terrorists would be very unhappy and would come to kill us because we're invading their space. Now, if we don't have to stabilize the region because the region has nothing that we need, we can bring those guys home and gals.
Stay with us, Richard. We're going to take some phone calls. We're going to continue chatting with you as well. Give us an update on Cydonia, would you? We haven't heard you talk about that in a long time. We'll be back. On our next Coast to Coast program, Whitley Strieber joins us. He's going to be talking about an incredible story. You don't want to miss Whitley. And by the way, this weekend, I'll be in the Washington, D.C. area at the X Conference. So if you're on the East Coast in that area, come on by. You can get all the information you need by going to the coasttocoastam.com website. Richard, Spirit and Opportunity, they still roving around Mars?
Well, not exactly roving. They're kind of hibernating for the winter.
Okay.
They're sitting in one spot with their solar panels, which are the old-fashioned kind, covered with dust, by the way, so they're not as efficient anywhere near as when they first landed back in 2004. But they're both very healthy, and when spring comes, they have avoided the budget axe at NASA, as you heard a few weeks ago, and they will be off and rolling. You know, you and I should have these extended conversations a little more often, because there's some pretty neat news going on over here at Enterprise on a whole range of issues, one of which is that when the rovers start roving again, the Spirit rover in particular, we're going to be posting a major piece on the, you remember the Martian figurine flap a few weeks ago?
Yeah, the one that Whitley put on his website during April 1st that said it was me waving at everyone.
Well, it wasn't. It's a real statue on Mars, photographed by the Spirit rover, and there's a whole bunch of other junk on the side of the of that, you know, area that Spirit was exploring called home plate, which it can revisit and take close-up images in the Martian spring, which will not come until after our election sometime in the winter here on Earth. And we're going to be posting a major paper basically challenging NASA to test the hypothesis. Because if it goes up close, which it can, and mm-hmm. takes close-up images of these objects and tests with the infrared spectrometer and with the abrasion tool and the, you know, Mossbauer spectrometer and all that, it will be able to convincingly prove to people that these things are not rocks, they're really artifacts. And the fact that Spirit was spared the axe by Mike Griffin, and that the head of exploration for Mars then quit in some kind of internal brouhaha right around the same time that all this went down, I think bodes well for a little political pressure to get the theory of artificial objects on Mars, former intelligence on Mars, former civilization on Mars, destroyed in a huge catastrophe millions of years ago, finally tested on site with specifically the Spirit rover, and we'll be laying out exactly how that can be done, and we'll be challenging NASA in a full-court press to do that. Now, the reason...
Do you like this slot, by the way, whenever I do a floating format?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
There's enough bright people who are still up listening to us.
Oh, tell me about it. And there are a lot of bright people waking up.
Yeah.
So, absolutely.
So, anyway, the reason that this is important is because we are gathering an amazing national television network mainstream base of support for what we're doing. I mentioned briefly the last time I was on the show that NBC was here and spent a whole day filming me for an upcoming special that's going to be aired on May 18th,
okay,
on the Sci-Fi Network, two-hour special. And they came here basically looking at, you know, what we could contribute to the premiere of George Lucas's new film, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. They're doing a film with Indiana Jones on the fictional idea of the crystal skulls in Central America and what they might mean. They got very intrigued with the idea of what we found on the moon, Data's head, or more appropriately, the lunar version of C-3PO.
Yep.
So they took hundreds and hundreds of our images back to New York. And I have now been in touch with them by email almost every single day. They've now started asking me for photographs of me back when I was working for Walter Cronkite as his science advisor, which are really depressing, and I don't want them on the air more than 4 seconds. I said, I will give them to you, but you can only air them for 4 seconds.
But you probably still are wearing that same bolo tie.
Oh, no, I'm not. No, it's even worse, George, and we won't even go there. Then today they sent me an email, and they said, we need to find original film of when NASA announced the face on Mars. So although they're not telling me, I have a feeling that the Enterprise mission and what we're doing is going to have a sizable chunk of the 2 hours, and I can't wait to see what it is, because the tone of the producers, I mean, the other day one of the producers said, we're all looking forward to meeting you. Now, this is going to be a hatchet job. I don't think they'd be saying that. So I have
a feeling that
the American people, through a major network around a major film, because I gave them some amazingly interesting stuff connecting George Lucas to Brookings, which nobody knows about and blew their minds.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling this program is going to be a very positive national network presentation of our data and our investigation and the political strength of this audience and other audiences we've been talking to for years and years and years. Well, they're not the only ones that are apparently interested. As you know, Vladimir Putin has been moved now from the presidency of the former Soviet Union, Russia, to the chairman of the party, and his deputy is stepping in as the new president, Medvedev or something like that, I think.
It's almost like he's saying, here's my handpicked guy.
Exactly. And he's chairman of the party, which is a position, by the way, that Premier Khrushchev held back when it was the Soviet Union. Remember, the chairman of the party really had the power, and the president was kind of titular and kind of a figurehead?
Yep. So Putin's going that way again.
Putin, the day that Putin is made chairman of the party, a major Russian television network calls again and asks to come here next week and tape a day-long set of interviews on Enterprise with me and Ken Johnston for a documentary to be aired on to 105 million people in Russia in the next few days.
The Russians like you.
Well, because
they followed you to the National Press Club.
Putin is using this as a wedge against the Bush administration, and he's basically saying to our guys, I think, and this is political speculation, if you don't make this public on some kind of reasonable time frame, we're going to. So there's a lot going on. Now, the other thing that's going on, you know, I received this rather remarkable invitation to speak in Denver in May, don't you?
At a libertarian conference,
I have been invited,
right?
To be one of the keynote speakers at the Libertarian National Nominating Convention on May 23rd in Denver.
Not that they're going to nominate you.
No. I'm basically presenting on NASA energy, national energy policy, space policy, and what we can do to fix this incredibly broken space agency that we're trying to patch up with Band-Aids and, you know, baling wire and solder. And I'm apparently going to have a very large audience because they're putting me in the main ballroom.
Good for you.
So if people want more information, what they can do, I actually have a number they can call to get more info. I don't have the thing up on the website tonight on Enterprise, but I will by tomorrow. But if people want more information as to my, you know, presentation, my address to the Libertarian National Party in Denver on May 23rd, they simply call 720-341-2193. That's 720-341-2193. And tomorrow I'll have a banner up on the Enterprise website, enterprisemission.com, and the link takes you to the Libertarian Party website, where they actually have a really nice blurb about what I'm going to talk about. And this is cool because what it allows us to do is to basically inject our research into the mainstream political dialogue going on in this country. There are rumors that Jesse Ventura might show up. There are rumors that Ron Paul might show up. And obviously, this audience is critical to making any of this political things happen. So why don't we go to some calls?
We'll take calls. We'll get a quick Cydonia update from you right before we're off this hour. East of the Rockies, you're on with Richard C. Hoagland. Hi, Ben.
Quick question. I used to work in a flexographic plant. I'm a designer, illustrator, cartoonist, et cetera. And they used to print long rolls of stuff with rubber plates very economically. And I'm wondering, what are the specs for the ink? Where can you get the specs for the ink? Where can you get the specs for the foil, which could come in large rolls, you know, a yard wide or wider?
Exactly. It's like the old-fashioned. Remember when you see the movies and I used to see these huge printing presses, you know, close-ups on film?
Yeah.
It's exactly that kind of technology. What I'm doing is I'm working on part two of this white paper, which we're going to publish on the Enterprise website. So all this data will be on the website. I'm also going to be using part of it in my address to the Libertarian Convention. But all of this information is important. It's specific. We'll have footnotes. We'll have links. We'll have people. We'll have everything you need to go and find out from these people yourself what is required to do this yourself, or get your town or your village or your community or your city to look at this seriously. This is the beginnings of an amazing transition to the kind of planet we all should have had, and we haven't even had a glimmer of being able to have until this technological breakthrough was in hand.
By the time you're done with your speech, Richard, it'll be 2012.
It'll be the
next election. I wonder if they know that. West of the Rockies, you're on with Richard Hoagland. Robert John in L.A.
Oh.
Go ahead, Rob.
Okay. Yeah, I've been listening and I wanted to share with you like a lot of common things, but one of them was I'm from Detroit and the Navy too. So
great.
Yeah, and I'm one of the few houses in my area that are we're 100% solar.
Oh, you are?
Excellent.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing that, Robert?
Just over a year.
And isn't it great to go out and look at the power meter run backward?
It absolutely does. we got a electric bill for the year was $1.90 something.
That is fantastic.
What did it cost you to build? I'm sure the cost is going way down, but when you did it?
It took us a year. You have to go through Edison, and you have to go through, because when you tap into their lines, you're actually selling electricity back to them.
Back to them, yeah.
And also, if, say, like there's a damage on the line, you're producing electricity, and if a worker gets up there, you're sending electricity both ways. So then you have to go through the state, and they have, in California, they have amount of money for the whole state, and if you get in early enough, you get a piece, and once you're okayed, then once you're done, then they put their part into it. But it cost us probably 30-some thousand.
You know how much it cost per watt?
I can't. I probably did know that at one time, but I'm on to other things, and so it doesn't do anything to my house, so I don't even know it's there. We have, you know, we experience no difference in anything. So.
Yeah, now, that $30,000, Richard, that $30,000 he spent, how much would it cost with this technology just mentioned?
Probably five or six.
Wow.
My God, that's a great deal.
And great, see, if instead of individual people, I mean, there are a lot of pioneers who want to get off the grid, because in a bad storm, and as you know, the climate is changing, there's weird things happening.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be part of a grid where you have ice storms or wind storms or hurricanes or whatever that can knock out your power. I mean, this afternoon I'm sitting watching the Pope in Washington, and my power fluctuated. And the computer got knocked off three times, and my TV went ding, ding, ding. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, I wish I was independent, because at critical times, I mean, that wasn't a critical time, but it was an interesting time, you don't want the power to fail. And, you know, when power fails on a large scale, as we saw in New Orleans, people die. This is not a luxury. This is not something that we can say, oh, I might want to do this someday. So the way to do it is do the municipal systems where people are not, you know, forced to pay these large capital costs, because for a lot of people, even $5,000 or $6,000 is a huge amount of money. But then you transition to where the price is going to keep going down. The more this stuff is produced, you know, economies of scale, it's going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And so we're at the threshold of an astonishing revolution. It's almost what Arthur Clarke used to call the anything box. Dear Arthur,
yeah.
If he'd lived to see this transition, because he was so much in favor of what Gene Mayoff was trying to do, and because politically the so-called free energy is still bottled up, this is certainly the next best thing, and it will pave the way politically for a transition to truly unlimited power that has no bad environmental side effects.
Well, he got close. He almost got to witness all of this, didn't he?
Well, he got enough. He got to witness enough to know that it was inevitable, that it was coming. But somewhere he is smiling.
Give me a quick Cydonia update, Richard. What's going on?
MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, has taken a color slice, a color image across the city, which is to the west of the face on Mars. And Mike Barra and I and some other colleagues like Keith Laney have been analyzing it, and we're going to be publishing a paper soon. I actually need to spend 24 hours a day doing nothing but writing in addition to a dark mission. And the astonishing things we're seeing on this new color image, where the smallest thing we can see down on Mars is on the order of a few inches across.
What is it?
We are seeing color spectral patterns, color prisms, meaning that those huge pyramids to the west of the face are made of glass.
And they're throwing off this prism.
And they're throwing off rainbows. I showed it to Robin, who was my best skeptic. If I can convince Robin what I'm seeing, then I know I can convince anybody, because she has got to be the world's worst, or in this case, best skeptic. You really got to have a high threshold. The bar has to be set high to convince Robin that something is real. And when I get her to see it, and she said, "Oh, my, what's causing that?" So I showed her it had to be light coming down from the sun, scattering around inside the glass, and producing these rainbows, because there's no geology that can do that within the space of a few feet. Plus, we found a double tetrahedron on the top of one of the pyramids, almost like it was an altar or some kind of a ceremonial complex, with six little points like stars in a Star of David kind of insignia. So when we publish all that, people are going to have a wonderful time, because MRO is living up to its technical capabilities. And politically, we're putting in the queue a lot more areas that I want close-up photographs of with MRO, including, remember my Martian ocean liner?
Mm-hmm.
That's in the queue now. And I got a post the other day from someone. There's a whole field of very strange-looking, I don't know, almost like tetrahedral pyramids, like several hundred of them.
Yes, and you would have been a great science teacher, Richard.
Well, I try.
You know what? You
and
really,
I now have a
would've.
Really cool group of people to talk to, including my friend George.
Absolutely. John, Baltimore, go ahead real fast.
Oh, my goodness. I am blown away. My thought driving down here, I'm driving down to D.C., and I'm like, you know, there's Spirit and Opportunity been up there with the solar panels for 4 years. I was going to ask your last guest a question about solar.
And here we are.
I didn't make it. And here comes Richard with the solar thing, the whole solar thing. And then my next question was going to be about that figure on Mars.
See, so we saved you everything, John, because it's great, because, Richard, we're out of time, my friend. Dark Mission, The Hidden History of Mars, is it still for sale, my friend?
It's a New York Times bestseller. It's on the website, darkmission.net, and Mike and I are looking at a sequel. But it's doing incredibly well on Amazon, and anybody in the audience who doesn't have one, go out and get it, because now the fifth edition is available out there in bookstores everywhere.
Good for you. Good for you. Did this surpass Monuments?
Yes. Yes.
Good for you.
Well, I never made the New York Times bestseller list with Monuments.
No, that's
and
true.
And due to this audience, I have with Dark Mission, and it's only the beginning. I think we're on the threshold of many breakthroughs, George.
I love it. Richard, we got to run. Thanks. And I love you in this time slot whenever we do a floating format. For Caris Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Gina Salvati, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.